after I had worked with him all those years, he said, "Bob, you know I play this game like a regular." Well, the pain in that man's, Moses, eyes, the historian recalls. Here was a man, the most powerful man in New York State, telling about something that happened 30 years before, and it still really hurt him. According to Smith's daughter and confidant Emily, the former governor had wanted desperately not to hurt Moses, but he had no choice. Moses might deny in public that he was the candidate of the old guard, but Smith knew he was. And the old guard was not just a phrase to Smith. They were the men who had fought against his efforts to cement into place above the heads of the state's defenseless poor a roof of social welfare legislation that would give them some protection against the cold winds of illness, injury, old age, and unemployment. He knew that if not held in check by a Democratic governor, they would begin tearing down that structure brick by brick. No matter how deep his personal affection for Moses, he couldn't let them do that. And if Smith felt he owed Moses a lot, and he did feel that way, he owed Lehman a lot too, not only for Lehman's cash backing of his own campaigns, but for Lehman's vigilant maintenance of, and attempts to add to, the social welfare structure, for Lehman's continual gracious public reminders that he was only continuing Smith's work, and for the considerate requests for advice that had made Smith feel a part of state government again. Smith's personal feelings for Moses were something special, of course, but the former governor respected Lehman. And he had, after all, played a key role, perhaps the key role, in making Lehman governor. He couldn't try now, without any good reason, to oust Lehman from the post in which he had helped place him. "Most important," as he said to Moses, "I play this game like a regular." He had done so for 40 years. His rage and bitterness at Roosevelt had not yet driven him to the point at which he would later, for the first time in his life, break with the party to which he had given so much of it. When Lehman asked Smith to campaign for him, Smith did. But he campaigned only for the governor, not against Moses, avoiding any personal attack on him. The press, antagonized by Moses, made capital of Smith's presence in Lehman's camp, but Raymond Ingersoll, one of the few old Smith supporters on Moses' side, was able to reply that, "Governor Smith has never said a word against Bob Moses, and he never will." And Moses didn't attack Smith either. When, moreover, the two men met at a dinner party soon after the end of the campaign, friends who had been apprehensively watching out of the corners of their eyes saw that within minutes they were talking together in as complete a rapport as ever, Moses as respectful and Smith as friendly as in the days before the campaign. "Nothing could disturb that friendship," says the host at that dinner party. "Nothing." And the proof of how right he was, of course, came with the opening of the Central Park Zoo less than a month after the end of the campaign. It wasn't what Moses said that most antagonized voters. It was how he said it. He let his contempt for the public show. "As bad as his speeches read," one observer recalls, "they read a lot better than he read them." The problem was not, observers agreed, that Moses was an unimpressive figure on a podium. On the contrary, he was very impressive. Describing one Moses speech, a reporter wrote, "He stepped up to the reading desk, a great bulk of a man, leant comfortably forward, and began to speak with the clearest voice and the easiest manner in the world. His broad shoulders, heavy chest, jaw, and eyebrows, combined with the physical presence, the sense of poise and self-assurance he emitted, made him exude strength and power. His voice fit in. It was deep and resonant, just nasal enough to sting." But if Moses was a powerful figure, he was not a pleasant one. When he was introduced, his smiles, as the audience applauded, were brief, and the look on his face was more one of barely concealed disdain than appreciation. There was no acknowledgement of the applause. He generally cut the applause short by stepping abruptly to the reading desk and preparing to begin his speech, as if anxious to be done with it so he could depart for some worthwhile activity. As he read his text, he seldom bothered to look up, sometimes going 5 minutes without a single glance to acknowledge his listener's presence. When the audience interrupted him with applause, he stepped back with a look that indicated nothing so much as boredom and resumed reading as quickly as possible. "He made no gestures. He did not vary the note of his voice," wrote one reporter. "He gave no hint of oratory or of rhetorical periods. His only emphasis was a loudening of his voice to drive his points home." "He gave the impression that he was way above them," recalls running mate McGoldrick. "He was alienating them all the way through. He looked like nothing so much as a man dining at a poor relation's home, feeling strongly that it was an act of great condescension and kindness on his part to be there, and determined to let all the people present know he felt that way. The only time that pose was modified was when he got caught up in what he was saying. Then the steady loudening of his voice continued until it was very loud indeed, loud and harsh. His right hand, which had been resolutely kept in his pocket up until then, would come out, and it would begin to make the pounding gesture his aides had learned to dread. Because there was a microphone on the lectern on which he was pounding, the smack of the palm, thudding down to emphasize each point, would be magnified, and as it rang out over the audience harder and harder, faster and faster, an observer could almost begin to see them squirm, not out of boredom, but out of uneasiness, in their seats. As Moses stood before them shouting at them and pounding the podium while not bothering to look at them, he was, all too obviously, not appealing to them for their support, but lecturing them, telling them in no uncertain terms what he wanted them to do, and letting them know they had better do it. The reaction of audiences showed how Moses affected them. Invariably, there was more applause at the beginning of a speech than at the end. With each succeeding appearance, the enthusiasm of his audience waned. The number of people who came to hear him fell further and further below the number that had been expected. At a rally in Queens on November 1st that had been expected to be a high spot of the campaign, only one of every 5 seats in the Jamaica High School auditorium was occupied. Moses' last appearance showed how little remained of the public enthusiasm that had greeted his nomination. That enthusiasm had persuaded his campaign managers to rent the state's largest auditorium, Madison Square Garden, for a climactic rally on the Sunday night before Election Day. So certain had they been of an overflow crowd that to avoid unseemly jams at the entrance, they had printed tickets to be distributed in advance by local GOP organizations and had announced that no one would be admitted without a ticket and that the doors would be closed a half hour before the speeches began. On the night before the rally, stacks of tickets remained untouched in GOP clubhouses. Despite a frantic last-day effort to persuade loyal Republicans to take them and agree to show up, despite a decision to leave the doors of the garden open even during the speeches themselves in hopes that passers-by might wander in, far less than half of the garden's 25,000 seats were filled. The people who were present were so dispirited that when George Everett, a professional cheer and song leader, took the microphone at a few minutes past 8 to warm up the crowd, he asked them why they were so downhearted. When the candidate rose to speak, he saw, looming down on him from the balcony, thousands of empty seats. The arrangements committee had placed a small American flag on each seat on the garden floor below him to be waved by its occupant, and he saw staring at him a sea of flags rather than a sea of faces. And there, in front of the empty seats, spotlighted in the center of the cavernous, half-empty arena, the candidate stood, pounding his palm hard on the lectern, lashing out in a voice loud and angry, almost ranting, the featured performer of a program that, the Times reported, was marked by more attacks on personalities than any similar meeting in recent political history. At the polls, the verdict of the people was even clearer. It was Lehman, 2,201,729, Moses, 1,393,636. Robert Moses, the candidate of the party favored by an overwhelming majority of the state's voters, a candidate for whom, the Herald Tribune reported, the GOP waged the hardest campaign that party has waged for a state ticket in a half dozen years, a candidate who had entered the campaign on the very crest of a wave of favorable publicity that had been 10 solid years in building, lost by more than 800,000 votes. His percentage of the votes cast, 35%, was the smallest percentage polled by a gubernatorial candidate of any major party in the 157-year history of New York State. As George Fearon had predicted, he dragged his party to defeat with him. For the first time in 21 years, the GOP lost both houses of the state legislature. The GOP won back the assembly the next year and didn't lose it again for another 29 years, until the Lyndon Johnson landslide of 1964. The year in which Robert Moses headed the Republican ticket was, in other words, the only election in a 50-year span in which the GOP lost both houses. He lost upstate communities that no Republican candidate for any office had ever lost before. He even ran behind Lehman in the total upstate vote. This fact so astonished veteran political reporters that they refused to believe the unofficial election night tallies that first revealed it. The old guard, which had foisted Moses' candidacy upon the GOP, was adequately punished. Its influence would remain strong in the party, but county leaders who couldn't afford to let their local candidates be caught in the undertow of the sinking of a poor candidate, and who were determined that one as poor as Moses should never again head the ticket, would never let the old guard hand-pick another candidate. His candidacy was its Waterloo. Moses was in later years to attempt to alibi away his defeat by saying that he had simply been one of the many candidates caught in the landslide vote by which the nation in 1934 expressed its approval of Franklin D. Roosevelt. On the day after the election, he told an interviewer, "I said when I went into this campaign that I did so knowing it was an attempt to swim up Niagara." No one, he said, could have beaten a New Deal supporter in New York State in 1934. This is true in part. The New Deal landslide of 1934 swept right-wingers to defeat all across the country. But Moses' explanation does not account for the size of his defeat. His previous popularity, the top-heavy GOP registration in the state, the lavish financing of his campaign, all these factors had led keen political observers like Barron Warren to predict at the time of his nomination a campaign that would be close no matter what the national trend. It was, these observers concluded after Election Day, the reaction of voters to personal, not party, philosophy, as well as to Moses' personality, that had eroded the support with which he entered the campaign. Swimming up Niagara was one way of looking at Moses' campaign. In brilliance of strategy and execution, it was perhaps more comparable to the charge of a light brigade. The definitive word comes from Joseph McGoldrick. McGoldrick was running on Moses' ticket, but since he was running for a city office, comptroller, only in the city. At the beginning of the campaign, he was approached by a pollster named Harry Gordon Lynn, whom politicians, including Al Smith, regarded as amazingly accurate. Lynn was doing the polling, secretly, for Lehman, but he came to me and said, for $2,000, as long as he was doing it for Lehman, he would do it for me at the same time, McGoldrick recalls. Lynn's first report to me was that Moses would lose the city by $550,000, but I would win it by $75,000. He said, "Moses is going to be defeated, but don't worry, you'll win." The second week, he said Moses would lose by $600,000, but I'll still win by $50,000. The third week, it was $700,000 and $25,000. And on the Friday before election, he came in and said, "Boss, you can't make it. Moses is going to lose the city by $800,000, and you can't overcome that. You're going to lose by about $25,000." And that's approximately what happened. I lost by $23,000. Moses needn't have lost by nearly as great a margin as he did, McGoldrick says. In fact, if Moses had held his deficit in the city to the $550,000 figure at which it stood at the beginning of the campaign, and had retained the normal GOP support upstate, he might well have won the election, for GOP candidates normally came down to the city line, compiled a margin above the northern boundary of the Bronx, with an edge of more than 600,000 votes. It was his tactics and personality, not national attitudes toward the New Deal, that persuaded tens of thousands of potential supporters to vote against him. "He booted that campaign himself," McGoldrick would say flatly. "If it was a disaster, he made it one." On election night, Moses was careful to show an elaborate disregard of the vote. Reporters ushered into his apartment at 7 Gracie Square saw him poring over a map of the city, outlining park and playground projects while he whistled softly, and giving only perfunctory attention, apparently, to the election returns relayed to him. "I haven't the slightest regrets in any way, shape, or manner," he said. "I've done the best I could. I've conducted an honorable campaign and adhered to my convictions. That's all there is to it." And he said that he was planning to return to his park work the next morning. There was no question about his returning to his city job, of course, but the fact that he included in the statement his state park work showed that he knew Herbert Lehman much better than his campaign attacks on the governor would have made it appear. For Lehman's treatment of Moses after the campaign was the definitive word on the governor's character. No sooner had the landslide aspects of his defeat of Moses become apparent than the Daily News, whose publisher was temporarily feuding with Moses, called on Lehman to oust his disloyal subordinate, and so did key legislators and a number of the governor's most influential supporters, including Farley and Flynn, and, according to some sources, President Roosevelt. Now, with Moses' prestige, his previously invulnerable armor against ouster moves riddled with holes, was the time to bring pressure on the members of the State Parks Council to elect another chairman, they said. Al Smith heard what was going on and hurried over to Lehman's apartment at 820 Park Avenue to urge the governor not to move against Moses. He needn't have bothered. Lehman was bitterly hurt by Moses' charges, but he would not allow personal feelings to intervene with his duty. "We have differed in the past and probably will in the future, but in the planning and administration of parks, parkways, and recreational facilities, Bob Moses has no superior on the face of the world," the governor announced. Moses could continue to head the state park system as long as he was governor, he said. "He was terribly sensitive because he said I called him a liar in the campaign," Moses would recall. "But I found him a very nice fellow to deal with, a very decent, honorable, honest fellow. He always supported me when he was governor." Moses should have known that Lehman would support him. After all, the cowardly, sniveling, lying weakling had always supported him before. Why did Robert Moses, previously so talented at public relations, antagonize the public during the episode in his career in which he most needed its support? In part, because his success in public relations had been due primarily to his masterful utilization of a single public relations technique, identifying himself with a popular cause. This technique was especially advantageous to him because his philosophy, that accomplishment, getting things done, is the only thing that matters, that the end justifies any means, however ruthless, might not be universally popular. By keeping the public eye focused on the cause, the end, the ultimate benefit to be obtained, the technique kept the public eye from focusing on the methods by which the benefit was to be obtained. The technique was also especially advantageous to him because its focus on the cause kept his personality safely blurred. Moses' use of the technique was a totally conscious one, knowing precisely what he was doing. The first rule is to stay on the side of the angels. He continually urged reporters, under the guise of modesty, to stick to the parks and playgrounds and bridges and don't write about me. And he had consistently made sure that his instructions were followed by furnishing only bare, carefully selected facts about himself. From the moment in 1925 when he dramatically propelled himself into the public consciousness by announcing that he was fighting for parks against a little group of selfish millionaires, he had identified himself so thoroughly with the glowing cause of parks that for 9 years the public had seen him always through that glow. Everything he did, he said, was in the name of parks, and of course of parkways and bridges that helped people reach parks, and the public believed this. After a while, he began, also consciously, to identify himself with related battles against crooked politicians and red-taping bureaucrats, and so cleverly did he make this additional identification that the public accepted it, too. During those years, the public never saw Robert Moses the man. But in a race for public office, the public focus is more on the individuals involved. Causes championed by a candidate are important to voters, but mainly as they help illuminate his personality and philosophy. It was a man they were voting for, not a constitutional amendment. They wanted to see the man. And they did. Robert Moses' only campaign for elective office tore away from him the protective coloration in which he had always appeared before the public and stripped him naked to its gaze. As a candidate for elective office, he was no longer only Robert Moses, the fighter for parks. For the first time, the public got a good look at Robert Moses the man, and it didn't like what it saw. This explanation, of course, does not answer another question. Why couldn't a man as skilled as Moses at manipulating and charming people he needed charm the voters now that he needed them, conceal from them his philosophy and personality, persuade them, at least for a period of a few weeks, that he understood and sympathized with their aims and aspirations and wanted to help them achieve those aims? Why couldn't he keep the voters from knowing, at least for a period of a few weeks, what he thought of them? The answer to this question lies somewhere deep in Robert Moses' nature. In part, it lies in the arrogance that was that nature's most striking manifestation. Robert Moses' arrogance was first of all intellectual. He had consciously compared his mental capacity with other men's and had concluded that its superiority was so great that it was a waste of time for him to discuss, to try to understand, or even to listen to their opinions. But there was more to his arrogance than that. Had it been merely a product of a consciously reasoned comparison, it would have been governable by reason, reason that must have informed him that if he hoped to win the prize he so desperately wanted, he must, for a period of a few weeks, conceal his contempt for the public. Had his arrogance been merely intellectual, he could have disciplined himself, this man with a will strong enough to discipline himself to a life of unending toil, for the few weeks necessary to give him a chance at the governorship. But his arrogance was emotional, visceral, a driving force created by heredity and hardened by living, a force too strong to be tamed by intellect, a force that drove him to do things for which there is no wholly rational explanation. It wasn't just that Robert Moses didn't want to listen to the public. It was that he couldn't listen, couldn't, even for the sake of the power he coveted, try to make people feel that he understood and sympathized with them. And there was something else behind Robert Moses' arrogance, a strange, flickering shadow. For not only could Robert Moses not help showing his contempt for others, he seemed actually to take pleasure in showing this contempt, a deep, genuine pleasure, a pleasure whose intensity leads to the suspicion that, in a way, he needed to display his superiority, with a need so great that he simply could not dissemble it. How else to explain the fact that, even when he was appearing before the public to ask for its support, he could not help ostentatiously flaunting condescension and boredom, boredom even at its applause? Robert Moses may, moreover, have understood that he had this need. He may have understood that he would not be able to appear before the voters without having to show them, so clearly that there could be no mistake about it, how much he despised them. For such self-knowledge would explain, and it is difficult to find another explanation, his decision to shun, to so perhaps unprecedented an extent, all public appearances save for a few formal speeches. Such an explanation also helps to illuminate Moses' otherwise almost inexplicable treatment of the press. Nobody understood the press and how to manipulate it better than he, and therefore he must have known, intellectually, that he would forfeit its support, support he both needed and wanted, if he attacked reporters personally and directly. Something far stronger than intellect, something stronger than considerations of strategy, stronger even than a chance for the governorship, was driving him, something that made it simply impossible for him to accept criticism, even the discreetly implied criticism of the reporter's questions at his first press conference. As for the vilification that he spewed over his opponent and everyone connected with him, former friends as well as enemies, it is difficult to escape the conclusion that the explanation for this, too, lay in character rather than campaign tactics. Since his earliest days in power, Moses had tried not just to defeat, but to destroy anyone who stood in his way, by any means possible. The definitive word on Robert Moses' gubernatorial campaign may be an unconsciously revealing remark that Moses made years later to his friendly biographer, Cleveland Rogers. "I made the only kind of campaign I knew how to make." Chapter 22. Order Number 129. To the extent that Robert Moses had lost his popularity, however, it was to be restored to him almost immediately by his most powerful enemy. Franklin Roosevelt had said of Moses, "I don't trust him, I don't like him." As governor, Roosevelt had been forced to ration himself to occasional sips of revenge on the man who had frustrated his dreams for a Taconic Parkway, humiliated him, and viciously ridiculed not only himself but his wife. But now Roosevelt was president, and he evidently felt it was time to indulge himself. The president's move against Moses had actually begun in February 1934, months before Moses' gubernatorial race, but it had been kept completely secret from the public for that entire year. Corporation Counsel Paul Windels, one of the handful of men aware of it during 1934, recalls vividly how he first heard about it. "On February 22nd, I'll never forget it, I was sitting home reading the Sunday papers in my home on Pineapple Street when LaGuardia called. He said, 'What are you doing?' I told him. He said, 'Well, I'm down in Bay Ridge making a talk, and I'll be by in about 20 minutes to pick you up.' I got in the car, and no sooner did I sit down than he cut loose. 'Jesus Christ, of all the people in the city of New York, I had to pick the one man who Roosevelt won't stand for, and he won't give me any more money unless I get rid of him. Jesus Christ, I had to pick the one that he hated. Jesus Christ!' He was shaking his fists in the air and shouting, 'Jesus Christ! Jesus Christ! 7 million people in the city, and I had to pick the one Roosevelt can't stand.'" LaGuardia, unfamiliar with state politics, had been unaware when he brought Moses into his administration, at least partly because he thought Moses could help him obtain New Deal public works funds, of the hatred between Moses and the man who was the New Deal, and Moses hadn't bothered to tell him. But LaGuardia hadn't been allowed to remain in ignorance for long. On February 21st, Harold Ickes, Secretary of the Interior and Administrator of the Public Works Administration, having summoned the mayor to Washington on direct orders from the president, informed the mayor, on direct orders from the president, of the president's feelings and demanded that LaGuardia dismiss Moses from the board of the PWA-financed Triborough Bridge Authority. In Ickes' secret diary, he wrote that LaGuardia regretted the situation and said that if he had known it existed, he wouldn't have thought for a minute of putting Moses on the board. He expressed the highest regard for the president and asked me to give him a few days to see what he might work out. But in the next few days, LaGuardia was able to work out nothing, for Moses did not prove at all cooperative. The mayor may have expected Moses to quietly resign. After all, Moses was his appointee, and it is traditional in American politics for an appointee to resign when the appointer wishes him to. Moreover, there was so much at stake here, a vital project for the city which could be built only if the federal government was willing to pay for it. One man surely could not think of standing in the way just so he could be in charge of it. And while Moses could not be forced to resign from the Triborough post, he had drawn the Triborough law so that authority commissioners could be removed only on stated charges after a formal hearing, he held his park commissionership, a post both men then considered much more important, only at the pleasure of the mayor, and the mayor therefore possessed a powerful weapon. He could threaten to remove Moses from the more important post unless he resigned from the less important. But Moses had learned, from his dealings with Roosevelt when FDR was governor, that he could force a governor to back down by threatening to publicize certain matters, such as requests for patronage. He had learned that he could force a governor to back down on more complex issues by simplifying them through a threat to resign over them, a threat which reduced the issue to the question of whether or not the public wanted him to continue in office. And now Moses employed the same technique on a mayor. He told LaGuardia that if the mayor insisted on his resignation, he would resign all right, but he would resign not just from the Triborough post, but from the park commissionership as well, and would issue a public statement disclosing why he was resigning, a statement making clear that the mayor had bowed to outside pressure to remove a city official who had done nothing to justify such treatment. LaGuardia had picked up Windels on the day after his conference with Ickes to ask the sage of Pineapple Street for advice. Recalls Windels, "I said, now look, you've been elected mayor on the theory that you are going to run an absolutely independent administration. You can't start off by knuckling under to outside dictation. If you do, your name is going to be mud. I told him that if he ousted Moses, the public would believe that he could be pressured in a situation like this, and throw out a man who the public thinks is wonderful, and I told him, if you do that, you'll never be able to erase that from the public's mind." From others, including City Chamberlain and New Deal brain truster Adolph A. Burl Jr., the link between the city and federal administrations, LaGuardia received the same advice. Burl telegraphed, "The President, personal. Moses' matter probably will become a national incident within a few days. I think this is one of the things you cannot do unless there are reasons other than personal giving ground for public defense. Moses will certainly resign, not merely from Triborough, but from city administration, stating his position, of which our opposition friends are prepared to make the most. I hardly know Moses, but suggest there might be more real devils to fight." LaGuardia stalled. Repeatedly he promised Ickes that Moses' resignation was imminent, and repeatedly he came up with excuses for new delays. But Roosevelt was, Ickes wrote in his diary, implacable. The president was determined to have his revenge, and in case that determination flagged, and there is no reason to believe it ever did, little Lewis Howe and Big Jim Farley were there to keep it fresh, both of them urging him on. He instructed Ickes to take a more forceful tone. The PWA chief, who hardly knew Moses, was to confess later that, "From the beginning, I had no stomach for this whole affair. I was in the unhappy position of having to admit to myself that Moses was an efficient administrator and a public-spirited citizen. But," he said, "my loyalty ran to the president, and I was determined to work it out to his satisfaction if I could." He told LaGuardia that he would not approve new Triborough requisitions until the mayor had obtained Moses' resignation from the Triborough board. LaGuardia stalled. Then Ickes said that he would not approve a single new PWA project of any type in New York City, not hospital, school, or subway, until Moses resigned. Still, LaGuardia stalled. He would make up promises, and then he would break his promises, Ickes wrote. It was, "Give me this payment and I'll get rid of him next week," that kind of thing, Windels recalled. And the stalling succeeded in keeping payments coming for Triborough and the other projects. Then came the gubernatorial campaign, with Moses running as a Republican. "Naturally, I had to declare a truce during that period in order to avoid a charge that I was playing politics," Ickes said. More requisitions were approved. But as soon as the votes were counted, the truce was off. On November 7th, the day after the election, Moses sent to Washington new Triborough requisitions totaling $8,100,000. The requisitions reached Ickes' desk on November 8th, and on that date, the PWA administrator telephoned LaGuardia and told the mayor that they would stay on his desk, unsigned, until Moses' resignation lay there beside them. Furthermore, Ickes said, no new PWA projects would be approved for New York City. and the administrator apparently made a further threat. In his secret diary, he wrote, "I am considering refusing to honor requisitions for funds for projects already underway in the city, an action that would throw out of work the tens of thousands of men now employed on them." All through November and December, the drama of revenge and power played on. Its cast included some of the most colorful characters in American politics. On one side, jaw jaunty, cigarette holder cocked, face open and friendly, the master politician in the White House. Beside him, the old curmudgeon of Interior, the scarred, doughty reformer from Chicago, almost the incarnation of lonely, righteous, and inexhaustible pugnacity, one reviewer was to call him, who in less than 2 years on the national stage had proven himself a character actor of the first magnitude, winning the public's heart with the dour, skeptical, but kindly glare that he flashed at it over the top of the rimless spectacles that were forever slipping down along his nose, and with his flawless performance as the tart-tongued, terrible-tempered, but invincibly honest defender of the public interest. On the other side, a modern Horatius on another unfinished bridge, one reviewer was to call him, Robert Moses, seriously ill and confined for most of the drama to his home with an influenza which had deepened into an illness, variously described as pneumonia or nervous exhaustion. In the middle, glowering out from under his big black Stetson, the prickly little flower of City Hall. Circling around these stars, spear carriers perfectly typecast, the burly, bald, gregarious Postmaster General, the lean, sharp-eyed, sardonic city chamberlain, and the wizened little gnome whose proposed appointment to a minor state park post a decade before had been the drama's prologue. Any audience would have been delighted at the show, but no audience got to see it. It played day after day and week after week behind closed curtains. Not a word of the dispute, not a hint that there was one, was uttered over the airwaves or printed in a newspaper. Moses' grim fight went on in absolute secrecy. On November 21st, the PWA board was scheduled to meet at 2 o'clock to approve a long list of projects. Shortly before the meeting began, Ickes slashed off the list everyone located in New York City. Then he telephoned LaGuardia to tell him what he had done. There are indications that Moses' loss of popularity in the gubernatorial campaign was weighing heavily in the scales on which the mayor was weighing the alternatives. Windels had told him he couldn't oust a man who the public thinks is wonderful, but apparently much of the public no longer thought Moses was wonderful. In conversations with him, the mayor, if he did not ask him to resign in so many words, apparently pressed more forcefully the suggestion that the whole city should not be made to pay for his seat on the Triborough Board. In reply, Moses apparently pointed out that there was no way he could be removed from Triborough except on charges. Telephoning Ickes, LaGuardia pointed this out. As Ickes recalled in his secret diary, "I told him that was his funeral, not mine." LaGuardia huddled daily with Windels now, and with C.C. Burlingham, the grand old man of the reform movement whose opinion the mayor valued so highly that, from him and from no one else, would he take a scolding. Both men argued, Windels on political grounds, Burlingham on grounds of principle, that he should not knuckle under to Roosevelt. The mayor was torn. On the one hand, Windels believes, he realized that it would have painted an indelible picture of him in an unfavorable light. On the other hand, there were his dreams for remaking New York, dreams which would be impossible of realization without the federal funds which Roosevelt alone could provide. Shrewdly calculating politician that he was, Fiorello LaGuardia was weighing the alternatives, always weighing. Then, on December 26, 1934, Roosevelt and Ickes threw on those delicate scales something that weighted them to the president's side. It was an official general PWA order. Administrative Order No. 129 was its title, and it stated flatly, "Hereafter, no funds shall be advanced to any authority, board, or commission constituting an independent corporation or entity created for a specific project wholly within the confines of a municipality, any of the members of the governing body of which authority, board, or commission holds any public office under said municipality. The order obviously applied to Triborough and to Moses. By coincidence, it also applied to another New York City official, Tenement House Commissioner Langdon W. Post, who was a member of the Municipal Housing Authority, which was also receiving federal funds, but Ickes privately assured LaGuardia that the order would not be enforced in Post's case. Post stayed out of the controversy because he was away on an ocean cruise. It had almost the full force of law. It had the full force of an official regulation of the agency financing Triborough, and, Ickes told LaGuardia, it embodied in those official regulations what he had previously said privately, that no money would be given to Triborough until Moses was off the Triborough board. Most important, it gave LaGuardia a public excuse for ousting Moses. An official PWA rule forbade Moses to serve. Its issuance was the move of a fox. The president helped me draft this order, Ickes diaried. But the fox was growing reckless. Previously, the president had been careful, always letting Ickes do the talking with LaGuardia, not letting himself become directly involved. Now, he discussed it, the order, personally with LaGuardia, Ickes wrote, and Roosevelt made another move. Either he himself or Ickes, and probably both, told LaGuardia that if he felt he could not force Moses to resign, they would be satisfied if the mayor promised Ickes, in writing, not to reappoint Moses when his term expired on June 30, 1935, well before the bridge would be finished. This combination of moves stripped LaGuardia of excuses that he could make to the president, if in fact he still wanted any. It gave him the public rationale he would need to justify ousting Moses, and it gave him a private rationale to make to Moses. When he received a copy of the order, it had not been released publicly, of course, he showed it to Moses, apparently to prove to him that he had no choice but to give in. Then the mayor headed for Washington, where he met Ickes, and on Thursday, January 3, 1935, secretly swore to the PWA administrator that he would put the promise in writing as soon as he got back to New York. But the mayor had miscalculated, as had Roosevelt and Ickes. They may have believed that Moses' loss of popularity had stripped him of his armor, and that Order No. 129 had left him weaponless, but they were wrong. For Moses still possessed a weapon more valuable even than his popularity, his mind. He conceived a masterstroke that simultaneously won him back his popularity and turned the tables on his great enemy. While LaGuardia was in Washington, he did the one thing that no one involved in the closed curtain drama had expected. He leaked the order to the press, and thereby pulled the curtain up. There, suddenly spotlighted before the public, stood the President of the United States of America, caught in a most unbecoming posture. And the President was only one figure in a tableau that might have been lifted intact out of that traditional melodrama, Our Old Homestead. In that melodrama, a villain used the power of money, the mortgage he held on the old homestead, to force the proud beauty to yield to his dishonorable advances. In the drama that Moses suddenly revealed to the public, there was also a villain, the president, using the power of money, federal relief funds, to force the mayor to perform a dishonorable act, ousting from his job a faithful public servant. And this drama had a hero, too, for now that LaGuardia had agreed to side with the president, the faithful public servant was seen by the audience as a man standing alone without a single ally and fearlessly fighting for his rights against the two most powerful men in the country. Since, moreover, the critics and the audience didn't know, and never were to learn, the long background of the Roosevelt-Moses feud, their imagination supplied the traditional motive. Press and public assumed that the president was attempting to force Moses out of his job simply because he was a Republican and had criticized the New Deal in his election campaign. And just in case anyone missed the point of the drama, Moses supplied a narration, written with the brilliance that characterized his efforts when he had a legitimate point to make. "There are certain facts which should be known to the public," he said. The sole purpose of Order Number 129 was to force him out of his job. Ickes had admitted as much to LaGuardia, and Ickes had also admitted that I was honest and competent, and that the sole reason for the order was that I was not sufficiently friendly to the administration. He had refused to leave quietly, Moses said. When the mayor explained this situation to me, I told him that I should be glad to retire from his administration entirely if he wanted me to, but that I would not take a back door out of the Triborough Authority merely because there was pressure to get me out for personal or political reasons. He had refused, he said, because he wanted the American people to know what was happening, because there was a principle involved that was more important than himself. The federal appropriations for public works and work relief are the funds of all the people of the country. If personal or political considerations are to govern the expenditure of public works and relief funds by the federal government, this fact should be known to the public. Reaction proved as violent as Moses had gambled it would be. Unluckily for Ickes, the PWA administrator held a press conference every Thursday, and, not knowing that Moses had leaked the story, he held one as usual this Thursday, shortly after LaGuardia had left his office. To the administrator's shock, reporters began questioning him about Order Number 129, which he had believed was secret. As he later wrote in his diary, I was asked whether Farley had ever spoken to me about Moses. To that question, I could honestly say no. Then I was asked whether the president had ever done so. There I had to lie, but again I said no. The lie was to force the press to link Roosevelt with the order only in hints for a day or two, although the hints were broad indeed, but it did nothing to cool its ardor for the story. LaGuardia had boarded his train back to New York, confidently believing that the affair was still secret. Sealed off from the world in a private compartment, he made the trip with that confidence unimpaired. But when he swung off his train at Pennsylvania Station at 9:30 p.m., he saw a pack of reporters running toward him along the platform. Luckily for the mayor, an aide, Lester B. Stone, had been telephoned by a reporter for a statement, had thus learned that the story had broken, and had hurried to the station. Stone reached the mayor a few steps ahead of the reporters, pulled him aside, and told him what had happened, giving him a moment to think. No one ever accused Fiorello LaGuardia of needing more than a moment. When the reporters engulfed him, he did not admit that he had agreed to dismiss Moses. Instead, when he was asked, "What are you going to do?" he replied, "I'll think it over." And he decided that night to postpone writing Ickes the letter he had promised. That proved to be a wise move, for the next day, as one of his advisors was to put it, the shit hit the fan. The public, that most fickle of lovers, embraced Robert Moses in January as fervently as it had pushed him away in November. With the exception of the Daily News, there wasn't a newspaper in New York that didn't carry an editorial message to the mayor on Order Number 129 on Friday, January 4th or Saturday, January 5th. The ones in the Herald Tribune were a fair sample. Friday's said, "If Mayor LaGuardia allows one of the ablest of his public servants to be dismissed by a Washington official without shadow of cause through a secret ukase so extraordinary and so contemptible that the official himself is ashamed publicly to admit it, then it seems to us that Mr. LaGuardia might as well resign his mayoralty right now." That was Friday's editorial. Saturday's said, "If Mr. LaGuardia gives in, he will find that he has sold his soul, sold his administration, and sold the people of New York. It is not worth it. Let the federal politicians cancel the city's contracts. Show them who's charged with the conduct of the public business of the people of New York City." Was the Herald Tribune a Republican paper? The American, the Brooklyn Eagle, and the World Telegram were Democratic. Bureaucracy, patronage, politics, the American raged. If the order stands, it will be a lasting stain on the record of the administration, the Eagle said. Secretary Ickes is jeopardizing public confidence in the nonpartisan honesty of the National Public Works Administration, the World Telegram said. And the independent New York Times, normally so dispassionate and restrained, chimed in, if he, LaGuardia, has the backbone of a lamprey, he will stand by Bob Moses, right through to that judgment day which he is himself so fond of invoking. And outrage was not confined to the press. The public was reacting to the press interpretation of the drama, bureaucrats and patronage politicians playing politics with its money, as the American public always reacts to bureaucrats and patronage politicians. Before his gubernatorial campaign, Robert Moses had been a hero because the public had seen him less as an individual than as a symbol of resistance to politicians and bureaucrats. His conduct during the campaign had, by forcing the public to see him as an individual, stripped him of that cause. But now he was once again basking in its aura, and he was once again a hero. In a display of indignation that proved how completely the Moses masterstroke had restored its author to public favor, on Friday, the day after the storm broke, the Long Island Chamber of Commerce, the Conference on Port Development of the City of New York, the Park Association of New York City, the City Club, the Bronx Board of Trade, the New York Board of Trade, and the Merchants Association of Sheepshead Bay all held separate meetings and passed resolutions backing Moses and denouncing Ickes. On Saturday, it was the Elmhurst Manor Community Council, the Jackson Heights Taxpayers Association, the North Woodside Community Association, the Astoria Property Owners Association, the Madison Manor Civic Association, the Atlantic Avenue Businessmen's and Taxpayers Association, the Automobile Club of New York, the Corona Community Council, and the New York chapter of the American Institute of Architecture. The language of the resolutions was indignant, and so was the language of the letters to the editor that flooded into the city's newspapers, the Herald Tribune running 9 in a single day under the heading Politicians versus Public Servant, the Brooklyn Eagle running 11. New York's parks are the sign and signet of Robert Moses, a man I do not know, but whose hand I should be proud to shake, said one. Our mayor has repeatedly crawled on his belly before Washington in abject supplication. Are we, as citizens of the sovereign state of New York, to have a political mongrel from the Middle West instruct us as to who shall build our bridges and who shall plant our gardens? Confiding in his diary, Ickes blamed the uproar on LaGuardia. LaGuardia has followed a crooked course in the whole proceeding, he raged a week after the storm broke. He let Moses see the letter that I had written him, in which was incorporated my order. I called LaGuardia on the telephone on Monday, and before I got through with him, I told him very clearly and distinctly just how accomplished a double-crosser he in fact is. He equivocated and evaded, but I know that I had him dead to rights. This was a great disappointment to me. I had felt that LaGuardia was a man of real courage and substance, but in this matter he has acted like the cheapest kind of double-crossing politician. The mayor was frantically steering between the Scylla of losing federal funds and the Charybdis of losing the confidence of his constituency, and he had to steer small indeed. He attempted to make reporters see his predicament. When one asked how Ickes could hold back Triborough Authority funds he had signed a contract to furnish, LaGuardia replied, "That's like a lawyer telling his client that he can't be put in jail for something, and the client answering that he is in jail. I can't build on litigation. I need steel girders and brick, mortar and labor to build." But these attempts only made the storm in his city rage more fiercely. Then the mayor tried alternately to ignore the controversy and to deny one existed. He avoided reporters as much as possible. Once, finding a crowd of them outside his office door when he left one afternoon, after a day of refusing their requests for an interview, he shouldered violently through them. And when, on another occasion, they cornered him, he said blandly, "Everything is susceptible of being straightened out by reasonable men. There is complete harmony between City Hall and Washington." But Moses kept the controversy alive with such devices as weekly accountings of the steadily dwindling balances in Triborough bank accounts and tours of the bridge site for platoons of civic leaders, much to LaGuardia's displeasure. When a reporter asked, "How would Ickes's order affect Commissioner Post?" the mayor snapped back, "At least Post is on the high seas, and he can't issue any statements." The mayor was stalling. In the face of such a gale of public opinion, he apparently felt, either Moses or Roosevelt would have to turn and run for harbor. Ickes felt the same way, although he felt the man who would have to retreat would be the president. "This enterprise is a great mistake on the president's part," the PWA administrator diaried. "By making a martyr out of Moses, we are only serving to build him up." But it wasn't LaGuardia's or Ickes' feelings that counted. It was Roosevelt's and Moses. And when these two men were dealing with one another, they were not reasonable men at all. Not normal political considerations, but personal animosity, real hatred, hatred that had been boiling between them for years, governed their actions. Neither one would give an inch. Chauffeured in from Babylon on January 9th for a two-hour meeting with LaGuardia and Windels behind closed doors at City Hall, Moses emerged, noticeably pale and tired, to find reporters waiting. "Are you going to leave the bridge authority?" one asked. "No," Moses snarled. Without another word or a backward glance, he strode out of the building. When Ickes, after a week of trying and, as he put it, taking it on the chin on behalf of the president, finally secured an appointment with Roosevelt on January 10th, he half expected that, in view of all the turmoil, the president would try to work out a face-saving compromise. But, the administrator wrote in his diary the next day, "he told me very firmly that he wanted me to go through along the lines of the order that I have issued. No tri-borough requisitions were to be honored, unless the Moses matter is settled to the president's satisfaction." Apparently confident that he could break LaGuardia down and force him to agree not to reappoint Moses in June, FDR told Ickes pontifically that the thing to do was just to go along, say as little as possible, and let it work out. For a while, it seemed that the president was correct. On January 16th, he summoned LaGuardia to Washington for a private conversation. Returning to New York, the mayor told reporters, "Nothing is going to happen that will disturb the pleasant relations between the city and Washington. We simply cannot afford to let a break happen. We have too many public projects being financed by federal funds to let such a thing happen." A Herald Tribune Washington staffer reported that, at PWA headquarters, Mr. Moses' resignation was confidently expected as a result of Mayor LaGuardia's public remark. But if the president felt he was holding all the cards, he was overlooking the Trump, public opinion. And Moses' Trump suit was even longer than had previously been apparent. Roosevelt was forced to admit at a press conference that he had been kept informed of the controversy by Ickes. The president declined to discuss the matter further, but even the limited admission made news. "President aware of order on Moses," the Times headlined, and with this opening, newspapers finally told their readers that FDR was not only aware of the order, but had directed Ickes to issue it. The public protest rose to hurricane levels as delegations from 147 civic, business, and social organizations met in the auditorium of the State Chamber of Commerce building at 65 Liberty Street. The diversity of those delegations, there was one from the Fortnightly Library Club of Brooklyn, as well as one from the Manufacturers Association of Bush Terminal, indicated the extent to which the support for Moses extended through every segment of the city. There were delegations from the city's most prestigious civic organizations, the Citizens Union, the City Club, the Women's City Club, the Civic Council of Brooklyn, the Alliance of Women's Clubs, the Civitas Club of Brooklyn, and the United Neighborhood Houses, a central body which itself represented 49 separate settlement houses and other social work organizations such as the New York Urban League and the Educational Alliance. Sitting on the stage or in the audience at the State Chamber of Commerce Auditorium were many of the most respected and influential individuals in the New York City reform movement. Burlingham, Price, McCanany, Schifflin, and other old giants of reform who had been idols at the Bureau of Municipal Research when Bob Moses had been a young staffer there. Leaders of the middle generation of the movement, contemporaries of Moses, like Childs, Stanley Isaacs, and Morris Ernst. And leaders of reform's younger generation, such as Newbold Morris. Once, these men had all been friends and admirers of Moses. Many of them had been alienated from him by his display of vindictiveness and disregard for the truth during the gubernatorial campaign. But now there was a principle at stake, and these were men to whom principle was more important than personality. Forgetting past differences, they took him again into the shelter of their names and reputations and led